welcome once again to EWTN's Bookmark. A very interesting guest today, author Professor William A. Thomas, STL, STD, and his book, Authentic Marian Shrines of the World Book Series. This is 5 books, compendium of the Super Saints for Our Times book series as well. And it's available through the MarianInstitute.org, MarianInstitute.org directly, okay, to check that out. Oh, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you so much.
And we parked your truck out back with all your other books that you've got. How many books have you written altogether?
45 published books.
40 over what period of time?
Well, believe it or not, in the last 6 years, what happened was I had been asked to give a vocations retreat at a Benedictine monastery. And one of the sisters inadvertently locked me in the library. And so I asked, I said, when I was there for several hours, I said, Jesus, what's going on here, you know? And there were a lot of books, and I realized that I should write. Because I had a lot of ideas and a lot of things going on in my head, mm-hmm. and I said, I need to externalize these. And the fact was that with the compendium of the authentic shrines, I did it to honor Our Lady. Mm-hmm. And I realized, and, you know, let's say what Carlo Acutis had done in writing a classification of where some of the Eucharistic miracles were, I asked the question, is there a classification of Marian shrines around the world? And I asked our own Pontifical Marian Academy. Well, up to now, no. This is the definitive reference book. Okay. And so this is now in the Vatican libraries. Okay. This is now in our Pontifical Marian Academy as a reference book. So any authentic Marian shrine that exists, it's in these 5 volumes.
So let me ask you, when you say an authentic Marian shrine, does that mean there was an authentic apparition, or is there a direct connection?
Well, for example, Jasnagura, there was no apparition there, but she's known as Our Lady of Hope, mm-hmm. and she was hope for the Polish people. Likewise, in eastern Poland, you have Our Lady of Kodin, and that's a prodigious, like Jasnagura, prodigious image of Our Lady, where it attracts, like Jasnagura, 1 million people a year who come for the novena, for the procession.
So if there was no apparition, what was the progenitor of that?
Yeah, well, they turned to Our Lady. Cardinal Hollande, way back in 1940, consecrated Poland to Our Lady.
So during the whole war, during the Nazi invasion, the Russian invasion, they
trusted Our Lady as their protector. And that devotion, that Marian devotion, that popular piety, has continued in many of those Marian shrines where there haven't been apparitions. Now, the authentic apparitions we know, just off the top of my head, Fatima, Lourdes, Rue du Bac, La Salette, Gichwald in Poland.
Borang,
in Belgium, yeah. Right. Guadalupe. And then, of course, here in the United States, we have Our Lady of Champion, again, Our Lady of Hope, mm-hmm. where the call, the message, is one to catechize, mm-hmm. teach the children, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, in that regard, it's...
Have you seen, based on the ongoing over this, over the years, that Our Lady's message in a particular area was focused on a particular time period related to those people, or was it more general to the world?
Well, any time there is an intervention from heaven, we have to understand that Our Lady is Mother of the Church and Mother of each one of us individually, mm-hmm. and she knows us. And I can give, examples. I do give examples.
We give a lot of examples.
Yes, in this work, you know. So it's important that if we're looking for an authentic mm-hmm. Marian devotion as opposed to a false Marian devotion, I think that this sort of work is for you.
Well, you say in the beginning, the Most Blessed Virgin Mary is the Mother of the Church, and therefore every Catholic diocese in the world should have a designated Marian shrine where devotion to Our Lady will draw down great graces from heaven.
Yes.
So yes. What percentage of dioceses actually have Marian shrines?
Very few. Very few, which is very sad. In talking with Pope John Paul about the Diocese of Tarnow, mm-hmm. he often referred to it as the Diocese of the 8 Blessings. And the reason, Tarnow is a suffragan diocese of the Metropolitan Archdiocese of Krakow. Okay. And one of the reasons he mentions Tarnow in particular is the Diocese of the Eight Blessings. So I asked him, what are these eight blessings you keep referring to? And he said, they're the eight Marian shrines in the diocese. And that's why the Diocese of Tarnow has over 2,000 priests, and they're not short of vocations.
Well, that's your connection. You kind of allude here to the fact that she always comes to rescue, and the idea that bishops complain that there are no more vocations to the priesthood, so that they close down or sell churches while they cluster other parishes together. In doing so, they create an anonymous ecclesial gathering, and you're saying really the solution to that, at which you just alluded to, is Marian devotion.
Correct. In Gichfald, for example, when the parish priest asked Barbara Smolenska, one of the two seers, ask Our Lady to send us more priests. And so the answer came back, when the people pray, God will send the priests to them. So the prayer is a Marian prayer. She's mother of the church. And I would encourage every bishop in the world to designate a Marian shrine. Cincinnati, for example, does not have a Marian shrine. I know many dioceses in Ireland don't have a Marian shrine. And for this Jubilee year, for example, I wrote to the bishop and said, please designate a Marian shrine in the diocese.
You don't build one necessarily.
Yeah, just designate a church that has an image of Our Lady, a sacred image of Our Lady, but they wouldn't do it.
Right. So, why do you think that is?
Well, I think that they're lacking in an understanding of the role of Mary as Mother of the Church, Mater Ecclesiae. They lack an understanding of the Marian theology, that devotional life, that popular piety associated with Mary. And when they don't lead people in that type of devotion, people go slightly askew. Right. And they go off to places they should not go to. And that's the problem that we have.
Lady of the Roses and Queens or some other situation.
Correct.
They're listening to some particular, quote-unquote, visionary.
Yes. That's one of the big problems we're facing today in the church. People are kind of self-catechizing based on false prophecies of doom and gloom of some catastrophic apocalyptical event that's going to happen. That doesn't honor Our Lady in any way,
especially when it when whatever is being prophesied doesn't come true.
Exactly,
and it just takes away from it, and it also marginalizes the real Marian devotion.
It does. It does. Right. Yes, Our Lady is not honored by those places.
You said there must be a Marian devotion to any faith belief, even by the way of popular devotion to Our Lady and the saints. Why do you think that's should be?
Well, Pope Paul VI.
What does she have to do with her? I mean, Jesus saved us, right?
Sure. But there is an inseparability between Jesus and his mother. She was there at the fiat, at the right at the beginning, fiat voluntas tua, thy will be done unto me. She's the predestined one from Genesis 3:12. We know that right through, there's a typology she's expecting, and then she becomes the incarnate mother, the mother who bears, gives enfleshment to God. She's there at his birth. She's there throughout his public ministry. She's there at the foot of the cross. Why separate her now?
Right. Really the first disciple, really the first.
The first disciple, you know, she is really the par excellence
for
of what we are
called.
For a
church that's got accused of not raising up women.
Yeah, yeah. and you know, she is the most wonderful mother. She intervenes throughout the course of history. As we see in this work, when there is a plague or a catastrophe or something like that, she is there.
Right. What's interesting, too, you talk about not only in a sense of fostering vocations to priesthood, but you talk about everything, the grace that relates to what we need for the new evangelization and vocations, not only to the religious life, but also to married and single life, because we are seeing a big negative impact on married life, too, right?
Well, there are only four vocations that the church recognizes canonically. The married life is the perennial vocation, and from the married life come all vocations. The second one is the vocation to the singular life, the vocation to the religious life, and the vocation to the sacerdotal priesthood. Now, it's important to understand that we need to study what marriage is. But more importantly, what marriage is not. Mm-hmm. It's not a utilitarian type of coming together. It's not about a man loves a woman or the woman loves a man. It's about love between the two, not two loves. Love between the two. So that person then doesn't use the other person for utilitarian purposes, you know. There's a sad and a lack of understanding of what true marriage is. And I think the church should now focus on teaching a proper course on marriage.
Right, it's not a contract 50-50, it's 100-100, so to speak, as they would say. So, I mean, even in this particular book, what I'm looking at here, this is volume three, which features 118 through 218. So if there's five old books altogether, how many do you have chronicled altogether?
I have over 500 major Marian shrines. In total. The most preeminent one would be Fatima, simply because Fatima is proven to be authentic. It's worthy of belief. It's not a fifth gospel, but the message contains all the elements of the four gospels.
And don't you think the message also seems incredibly prescient today? I mean, the attack on the family, as Our Lady talked about, right?
The first appeal of Fatima is the call to believe, to believe in God. And why? Because of the influence, the cultural revolution of the Soviets, of the Bolsheviks, was atheism.
Well, it was going on in Portugal at the time, right?
It was atheism. And atheism has spread through the university system. So you can send a lovely young person to university, good Catholic, and they'll come out as a hippie, as an atheist, as a rebellious sort of person. And this leads on to the three major rebellions going on in the world today. The rebellion against God, the rebellion against the sacramental church, which is the instrument of salvation, and the rebellion against reason. And we find that there are fanatical groups out there who are unreasonable. They don't have reason.
Well, we live in a world where feelings trump everything, right?
That's correct, And that's the sad reality, because we can't be an emotional church. We have to be a teaching church, and we have to teach people. This is all about whether we go to heaven or not. This is about, you know, being called to the heights of holiness, being called to be saints of God. We're not saints after we die. We're saints while we live. And we have to live lives of heroic virtue, lives of holiness, where our focus is on Christ, not on doom and gloom, not on the false prophets, not on the false mystics, but on Christ himself. And through the sacraments, we struggle day by day.
Well, do you think part of the problem we're dealing with today is that, as we sometimes say, there either isn't a hell, or if there is one, no one goes there? And kind of the same. So if there is a heaven, everybody's going there kind of anyway. We're all going to get a curve. They're going to curve the test, and we're all going to get in there. So some part of it becomes, why are you bothering me?
Well, you know, this is where definitive teaching, dogmatic teaching, comes to the fore. And the Council of Trent, and every council since, has really emphasized the fact that heaven exists. Our Lady, even in Fatima, confirms it. She is from heaven. They ask, where is Amelia de Jesus? She is in purgatory. And then they have a vision of hell where the souls of the damned go. So these are confirmed dogmas in this apparition at Fatima, for example.
You would certainly think so. And I always remember hearing that she was going to be in purgatory to the end of time. People thought, oh, my Lord, if that's where she's going to be, where am I going to end up?
Well, that's a mistranslation, because I went back to the original documents there. It said Amelia de Jesus would be in purgatory. What I was looking for in the Portuguese was Até o Fim do Mundo, until the end of the world. That's the 1937 memoir of Lucia. But it doesn't say Até o Fim do Mundo. It says Muito Tempo, a long time. So what we can do is we can say, how long is purgatory? Is there a time in purgatory? Of course there is. Now, how do we compute earthly time with purgatorial time. Well, there is a mystic, Mother Speranza, from Colla Valenza, north of Rome, and she was in dialogue with our Lord, and she asked the question, how long is a year in purgatory? How do we equate? And he answered that one earthly year is the equivalent of 82 years in purgatory.
Okay.
So that's the time. And part of the purgation would be to learn something of God.
Right.
So if we're theologians today, it would be better to start now that we know something of God, because he has given us that capacity to be homo sapiens, that wise man capable of knowing and loving him. That's what's important, that we have the capacity to know and to love God. Like what Our Lady said, I find this the most remarkable statement coming from Our Lady in Fatima. Up to then, let's say, there was an element of obscurity. Who is this woman? Even on the cross, he said, woman, behold your son, and so on. But in Fatima, he says, or she says, God wishes to make me known and loved. Now, there's two elements at play here. To be known is the intellectual capacity. Who is Mary, the mother of Jesus? And love, the devotional side. And then if we do get to know her, and there are many great books out there, St. John of Eudes, for example, one of my mentors, and Father Mitch Pacwa's book on Mary is an excellent book. These will lead us to a true, authentic devotion. St. Louis de Montfort, it would be a mortal sin if I didn't mention him. And he writes the book True Devotion to Mary. He said true devotion is interior. It's not an exterior thing, it's interior, and it's constant. So it's the desire to pray the rosary every day.
So a person who has that true devotion to Our Lady, what does that do for their spiritual life?
Well, it gives them a moral certitude of heaven. You know, if you pray the rosary every day, you will be saved. And this is one of the 15 promises Our Lady makes, that we will get all the graces.
Because we're getting an interior change,
yes,
right, to that, right?
Exactly.
As you just said, not just the sitting there and counting the beads, but it's seen.
Sure. Right. It's recounting the life of Jesus, Jesus and his mother. You know, and this is important, that we keep focused. If we don't keep focused, we lose the plot. You know, it's often said about Peter when he got out of the boat and he was looking at Jesus. Peter actually walked on water. And then when he realized he walked, he looked down. He stopped looking at Jesus and he sank. See, this is what happens to us. We will sink if we lose the focus of Jesus.
You think that's been a big problem we've had?
Yeah. We're distracted by intrusions. We allow the intrusions in our life that are not necessary. We can block them out and say, I'm not interested in doom and gloom anymore. I'm not interested in the false mystics or the false prophets. I'm interested in scripture. I'm interested in learning the truth of the matter. I'm interested in authentic Marian devotion. Therefore, I'm going to go on pilgrimage to these authentic shrines.
Now, you talked about Fatima and the importance of that, but yet you're wearing actually a medallion there that relates to Lourdes and your position there. Did you ever, have you ever run into people who seem to want to compete between apparition sites?
No. I think that when I came across people anywhere, they were all devoted to Our Lady. But there was a different message. The Our Lady is professor at Fatima. She is of the School of Mary. She teaches us a pathway under her gaze. She promises that her Immaculate Heart will be our refuge and the way that will lead us to God. And it's very important that we grasp that, you know. Likewise in Lourdes, she says, tell the people to come here. Tell them to wash at the fountain. Tell them to walk in procession. The walking in procession, for example, is the public expression of the faith. In other words, faith isn't something private. It's something that we take out into the world with us, you know. And I'll give you an example. I went to a remote hotel in County Cork, and I ordered lunch. And lunch came, and then I made the sign of the cross, and I said the grace before meals. The manager of the hotel was looking at me, and she came over, and she said that was one of the most wonderful things she had seen in a very long time. She grew up as a Catholic and lapsed. But just that outward expression was sufficient for her to register the need to pray.
Right. And to key to probably a faith that's still there inside.
Yeah, exactly.
That kind of has been
rekindled.
Buried.
Yeah, rekindled.
Exactly, which is why it's so important to see sisters and habits and priests and clerics and things like that.
Exactly.
And like you said, processions and those things. So Our Lady at Lourdes didn't come to just set up a healing place for people? That wasn't really her major concern? Or how did that become the aspect of Lourdes?
Well, Lourdes is about Our Lady and the proclamation of her Immaculate Conception.
Right.
Now, this is one of the most important titles, because if you look back at how, and you could go back 600 or 700 years, how the Church tried to define her Immaculate Conception, right back to the Council of Basel, and they almost got it right. And previous to that, Stanislaus Popchinski, the founder of the Marians of the Immaculate Conception, Duns Scotus even, in the 13th century.
What a reason they call them a dunce, right?
Well, yeah. but here's the thing, that Pope Pius IX, blessed Pope Pius IX, whose body is incorrupt, in St. Lorenzo Fuori de Muri in Rome, he articulates with the help of Cardinal John Henry Newman. Mm-hmm. And it's remarkable because in the actual definition of the dogma of the Immaculate Conception, he doesn't use the words Immaculate Conception. Mm-hmm. They're reserved to Bernadette.
I see. Okay.
And so when Our Lady, on the Feast of the Annunciation, says, "I am the Immaculate Conception," her voice quivers with mm-hmm. emotion. Her countenance changes. She looks towards God and she says, "I am the Immaculate Conception." Bernadette didn't know what that was.
Right.
She had no idea what it meant, but she ran to the parish priest. And this leads us to something authentic, that any Marian apparition is reserved to the Church. I think false visionaries think because it's so-called private revelation, it's to them.
Right.
Any revelation from heaven belongs by right to the Catholic Church and should be reported to the Catholic Church for assessment. It's not for an individual to go on television or to go on a blog site and say, "Our Lady is appearing to me and this is what she says," and they make a fortune out of it.
On the YouTube channel or something,
or
their experience, their near-death experience or
correct.
What happened with those things. And obviously it's a lot easier for people to get these.
Sure.
And the fact is people are hungry, right, as you
absolutely.
Were indicating, because in some ways, because of somewhat, whether we like it or not, downplaying in a sense of the Eucharistic adoration and Our Lady and some of the other devotionals, people need those things. So if the Church isn't promoting that, then they go and look someplace else,
correct.
As you said.
Correct. Right? It can't be a DIY church where you do it yourself. It has to be an organized, even if the laity have to do it. But the bishop should be solicitous in identifying, because as you say, there is a spiritual famine out there.
Right.
People are longing to know. And yet when somebody volunteers to teach, they're rejected, they're rebuked, and say, no, we won't have any of that here. Well, this is wrong, clearly wrong.
Right. Let me ask you, of all the ones that you've looked into, what would you say the Marian apparition, besides, let's say, Fatima or Lourdes, that maybe people know the least of, that you think actually would have the most impact on people's lives if they knew about it?
Well, of course, that's a very hard question to answer. Guadalupe, of course, is ongoing, and we know the detail of that. But there are many very simple apparitions. I'll give you two, if I may. On Stromboli Island, which is a volcanic island, in the Aeolian Island series north of Sicily, the new bishop, Archbishop of Palermo, wanted to do an audit of how many churches and religious houses and hermitages do I have in my archdiocese. And they discovered there was a hermitage on Stromboli. And he sent some men out to clean it and prepare it and to see what could be done with it. And eventually, these men working away heard a little bell ringing. And they said, "Do you hear this?" And they said, "Yes." So it rang all the time. and they couldn't figure out where the sound was coming from. So they reported back to the bishop, and the bishop himself came out, and he heard it. And he said, this is amazing. Where is this bell coming from? And so they got some acoustic people from the University of Palermo, and they identified a particular wall in the Hermitage, and they opened it up. And there was an image of Our Lady holding a bell.
Oh, wow.
It's a painting, and it goes back to the 5th century. And so now it's a Marian shrine on the island, you know. Then you have the famous shrine, if you want, in Brittany of Le Folgoat. I think it's in one of those volumes, Le Folgoat. A woodsman had two sons. One of them was mute. In other words, he couldn't hear or speak. And the woodsmen in those days, they made charcoal, they chopped trees, logs. There was no electricity. And eventually he got tired when his kids grew up as teenagers and so on. So he decided to fold the business, and the other son went off, left the mute to do the work. And eventually the mute boy worked very hard, and one day he died. This is a short version of the story. And some years later, the Duke of Rono and his wife, along with the Abbot of Landivenec, were passing through with a group of soldiers. And they stopped to rest in the woods. And the Duchess discovered this beautiful flower. And I'd forgotten to mention, the only two words the mute could utter were Ave Maria. And she found this beautiful flower, and there was a beautiful scent from it. And she looked inside, and she saw the petals had come together to form Ave Maria.
Oh, wow.
So she said, I'd like to take this flower home. So one of the soldiers went to cut it. And she said, no, don't cut it. Take it at the bulb. And they dug down, and they found the incorrupt body of the mute Le Brennon, and the bulb was in his mouth. It was coming up. So it's beautiful.
Well, we are just out of time. I mean, you could go on, as you have in these wonderful volumes.
So I'll come back next year.
Thank you so much.
Oh, I'll come back
next year. Great to have you. And you're going to be on Jeanette Bankovic's show, so people, Jeanette Williams' show, so people can check that out. Professor William A. Thomas, STL, STD, author of Authentic Marian Shrines of the World, book series compendium of the Super Saints for Our Times book series. It's so voluminous. We don't even offer it religious catalog. You have to go to themarianinstitute.org to check it out. This is an amazing series of books. Check it out, and check us out next time right here on EWTN's Bookmark. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.